This year marks the 21st anniversary of September 11, 2001 attacks on the U.S. Last year, the U.S. and the world marked the 20th anniversary of 9/11. What made this date more important than the simple passage of time was that it was relevant. The 2021 event marking America's entry into what was to become known as the so-called Global War on Terrorism occurred less than a month after America's ignominious retreat from Afghanistan. The Kabul evacuation of August 2021 was the final act in a two-decade-long drama which saw the vision of a new American century espoused by an American neoconservative elite who looked to exploit the horror of 9/11 by turning it into a catalyst for world domination, run aground on the shoals of geopolitical reality, capsizing and ultimately sinking in a self-created storm of national hubris. The America that emerged from the 20-year policy disaster that was the war on terrorism, comprised of several distinct conflicts, including Afghanistan and perhaps most notably Iraq, was chastened and humiliated, but not defeated or humbled. There is a dichotomy between the geopolitical reality that the United States found itself in after 20 years of global neglect, while squandering the nation's blood, treasure, and reputation in the deserts and mountains of the West Asia-North Africa region, and the narcissistic arrogance of an American leadership elite unable and or unwilling to recognize the damage they had done to the American enterprise, and as such nullified their collective utility in crafting appropriate diplomatic, economic, and security strategies for recovery. 9/11 at 20 plus 1 is the first anniversary of this new reality.
Spiritual guidance for millions across the world.
Part 1.
Actually, what we see is a manifestation of the human spirit, a yearning for justice.
Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet of Islam, was brutally murdered along with members of his family. This was simply for his objection to the unscrupulous and unethical kingdom of Yazid.
I have a lot of sadness to think that he was the Prophet's grandson and that he was murdered by the caliph of his time, and that it was a senseless death in its way.
And why is the anniversary of his death, Ashura, commemorated throughout the world, even reaching Britain?
Why did Hussein stand and offered his blood? Was it just because he wanted to be killed? Or there was a message?
We go from a prophet, we go from Ali, who suffered himself death at the hand of an assassin. And then we move to the next stage, which is the martyrdom of a prophet's grandson. And so there is a kind of thread, spiritual threads, which connects them all up. And it's a thread which tells us about the fate of a righteous person, a fate of a righteous man.
He knew that he was going to get killed. On the night of Ashura, he told his companions that tomorrow all of us are going to be killed. So anyone who wants to leave, let him leave. He wanted this message to get through to the history that, look, when my grandfather talked about Islam, he did not talk about empire. He did not talk about the green palace of Damascus. He did not talk about armies. He did not talk about conquests. What he was concerned about was the spiritual life of Muslims.
It was these principles of Prophet Muhammad that were a source of great inspiration for Hussein. As a child, he looked up to his grandfather as the perfect role model. Prophet loved Hussein dearly.
We know that Hussein, as well as his brother Hassan, were much loved by the Prophet. And he had them on his knee and played with them. So it's quite a movie. Anybody who's been a father or a grandfather know how lovely that is. Imam Hussein was not just, an ordinary man. He was a Prophet's grandson. And he was beloved Prophet. And indeed, Ali, the Lion of Islam, and the fourth Khalifa.
In fact, Hussein was loved throughout the entire region. During his life, Imam Hussein very quickly became prominent for his drive to help the poor and enrich the lives of orphans, activities for which his father, Imam Ali, had been renowned. For Hussein to have had someone like Imam Ali as a father was a distinct advantage.
He was a strong advocate of human rights. And he had problems with people engaging in high society gatherings where the poor would be ignored.
In fact, this line of the Prophet's family remains to this day a source of spiritual guidance for millions across the world.
They were strong believers in God because they were strong believers in justice. They were strong believers in humanity. They're strong believers against oppression.
Their principles are studied to this day. Being part of this family, Hussein was well known for his exemplary morals. In fact, he is often compared to Jesus Christ, also a key figure in Islam.
What kind of a conversation would take place in between Jesus, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, or Moses if they were in a room together today? All these personalities were the same light. They were the same light giving us the message of humanity. And they cannot be restricted to one faith or one faction, but they belong to the whole world.
Jesus had very great concern for the poor, widows and orphans. Those are all things that I've heard about from the life of Imam Hussein. And he would highlight their experience. So they would have had a lot in common to talk about in how the people at the bottom of society should be raised up to the top so that society was focused on caring for them. And one of the famous sayings of Jesus is, "The first shall be last and the last shall be first." I'm not familiar with all the sayings of Imam Hussein, but I can imagine that he would have said something very similar, and they would have had a lot of similarities talking to each other.
Interestingly, this expression by Jesus reverberates in the Quran. As Hussein would talk amongst his followers, he would have recited this verse about being accountable on the Day of Judgment, that some will be lowered and others will be raised.
That is the last message that Imam Hussein alayhi salam gave to us, to speak against oppression, to speak against tyranny, to speak for the poor, to speak for the oppressed, to raise our voices, to help them.
The role of Imam Hussein mainly, principally, was to observe and enforce the enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil. And he was one man who would not bow down before the despotic and tyrant ruler like Yazid.
But who was Yazid? Quite simply, he was a tyrant, the repressive leader of a brutal regime. He had just been appointed by his father, Muawiyah, to rule over the Muslim world. This appointment would have a devastating effect on the history of Islam.
This was a point of no return. Should Islam, or the leadership of Islam, been kept in the hand of someone like Yazid, we would have now completely a different understanding of Islam. Perhaps we won't have Islam.
He was corrupt in the sense that he would allow mismanagement of the public affairs to be a norm. So it was a total corruption of the right and a total embracing of that which is anti-humanitarian, if you want to put it in those terms.
The Holy Quran considers justice to be the yardstick by which all merits should be measured. Essentially, how can you have peace of mind or peace in society when injustice boasts before your very eyes?
The life that Imam Hussein alayhi salam lives, it actually shouts opposition. He doesn't have to say anything. Just the sheer lifestyle he lives, the sunnah he enacts, is a direct opposition to the lifestyle, to the worldview of the Umayyad dynasty. So Imam Hussein alayhi salam was proactive. He brought the war to Yazid.
Yazid knew that Imam Hussein rejected his leadership. This agitated him. He was also aware of people's hidden love for Hussein.
I think Yazid wanted, by obtaining the legitimacy of Imam Hussein, want to be confirmed in his own authority, and if did not feel confident that he was, and he must have been aware also of the degree of popular support of Imam on his side. So it was an attempt to acquire legitimacy, and it was not a legitimacy which was merely, it was not just support of a particular faction, but it was a faction which was a prophet's line. And we know actually even successive caliphs try to get the successors of Imam Hussein on their side.
Yazid knew that he had two choices, either to obtain Imam Hussein's allegiance or to kill him. Either way, Hussein knew that he would not be safe to remain where he was living, just as his grandfather, Prophet Muhammad, all those years ago fled Mecca to Medina. Hussein was now leaving Medina to Mecca. Accompanying him were a small group of close relatives and loyal companions. Whilst Hussein was in Mecca, a movement had begun in a city called Kufa. They had heard of Hussein's refusal to pledge allegiance to Yazid and were gathering support to write letters requesting Hussein to take over leadership in their city.
It is recorded in the history that 18,000 people wrote letters to Hussein. As in some of those letters, we read, فَعَجَّلْ ثُمَّ عَجَّلْ Hurry and hurry, we are waiting for you.
The tragedy was that even in the sanctuary of Mecca, Hussein, the beloved grandson of the Prophet, was not safe. He was in danger, a conspiracy to kill him at the hands of the same people who claimed that they were followers of his grandfather.
I think this is one of those most tragic things, that someone like Hussein, peace be on him, had no other choice. He was left in among the Ummah, having no choice, no place to go. And he said, okay, they have told me that they would support me. I go to them and talk to them. And he continued moving.
Imam Hussein had actually sent an envoy to Kufa, his trusted cousin, Muslim ibn Aqil. This was to see if the people of Kufa really were committed to the pledge in their letters. On the other hand, Yazid became aware of the atmosphere in Kufa. In response, Yazid sent someone there to repress the uprising. This man was Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad.
In a matter of days, he changed the whole atmosphere of Kufa by threatening, by giving promise of wealth, by giving position to people. Suddenly, the whole ambience of Kufa was changed, which is very, very shameful, of course. A Muslim doing something like this for the promise of worldly issues.
Yazid's plan to quell the uprising in Kufa was successful. Imam Hussein's cousin was killed. On the way to Kufa, Hussein met a young man named Farazdak, who later became a famous Arab poet. He gave Hussein devastating news about the changes in Kufa and warned him against entering the city.
He said, "Qulubun nas ma'ak wa asyafuhum or suyufuhum alayk." The heart of the people are with you, but their swords are against you because they have sold the swords to Banu Umayyah, to Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad. So you are actually entering a city where people like you, but they are going to meet you with their swords.
Imam Hussein gathered his followers to tell them that the people of Kufa had turned against them.
And our followers, those who sent letters to us, have betrayed us. I just want you to be aware of this, where you are moving to.
In Kufa, Ubaydullah enforced a police state. No one was to enter or exit the city. It was a scary time.
At that time, a man came from Hamdan, a tribe in Yemen, for some business. He came to Kufa for some business and he was caught and he was arrested. And he said, "I didn't know, I have come just for business." And Ubaydullah thought that this is the best man to kill because he has no tribe here. We kill him to make an example out of him for others, that anyone capable of taking sword, remaining in Kufa, will be killed. And they killed the poor man, who was quite unaware of what was happening at all.
The army that Ubaydullah had sent was headed by Huwar, a military commander. His orders were simple: to capture Hussein and bring him to Kufa. Imam Hussein saw the army from a distance and waited.
Now, the beautiful thing is that Hussein had actually taken lots of water from the previous station. The first thing which appeared to Hussein, peace be on him, was that they were very thirsty. They had rushed. It was middle of the day. They had rushed. Some of them were on food. Some of them were on camels, on horses. And without asking them, "Why are you here? Are you enemies or are you friends?" he told his companions, "Bring the waters and let them drink. And also let the horses and camels drink."
This is abiding by the rules of war. He was abiding by, you know, the humanitarian values that are meant to be maintained when, you know, a Muslim is in the state of war. So offering water to those who are on the other side, Imam Hussein was always thinking about people as a whole, their destiny. He was always concerned for them.
This was the beautiful thing about it. The sad thing about it was that the first thing Hussein asked her is that, "Have you come to fight or have you come to support?" He said, "We have come to fight." And Hussein said, "La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah." There's no power but the power of Allah.
Huwar wanted to arrest Hussein and take him to the Umayyads, but Hussein resisted. The interesting point was that because Huwar respected Hussein and didn't want a confrontation with him, he agreed to let him move in a direction away from Mecca until he received new orders from Ubaydullah. A while later, Huwar received this new order, and the order was to force Hussein and his followers to stop and remain where they were. By that time, they had reached one of the most hostile deserts in the region.
When things came to this point, Hussein, peace be on him, asked his companions, "What is the name of this place?" People, of course, some of his companions were very familiar with the area. And they said, "This is Nainawa." And he said, "Is there any other name?" One of them said, "This is Ghazariya." And he said, "Any other name?" And one of them said, "This special desert is called Karbala." And then Hussein said, "Aradu Karban Wabala." This is distress and calamity and agony.
To add to the brutality, the now 30,000 strong army blocked the route to the nearby Euphrates River. This was so that Hussein and his followers would not have access to water.
And that is why the thirst was added to all that agony which was going on. And this actually made the Karbala the whole more tragic incident, that they not only killed the grandson of the Prophet, they killed him while he was thirsty, while his family were thirsty.
A particular detail which lingers in my memory is a terrible thirst, which Imam Hussein suffered during the siege. Karbala was actually quite protracted. You know, some people, many people imagine it was just one go, but in fact, far more drawn out. So in a way, it conveys in a certain very dramatic way the extent of the suffering.
But the suffering would not end here. Hussein and his followers were cornered, with no routes for escaping. But they would not back down now. Hussein and his followers were ready to stand. With all the respect that Hussein had gathered through his life, why were people ready to kill him?
The Emir of Medina, a commander of the army, everyone, they respected Hussein. They knew that Hussein is not the type of man that they can put up a fight against. However, I don't know, in the heat of that situation, what happened? That people were somehow deceived. استحوذ عليهم الشيطان فأنساهم ذكر الله, as we have in the Quran. Shaitan suddenly overcame them and they forgot ذكر الله, and they forgot the people who were the people of Allah.
And in that treacherous heat of deception, the troops who had claimed to be Muslims were about to manifest an ugly face of brutality against the Prophet's grandson.
It was not something that was unexpected. They all knew, even the women and children in that camp knew, that the enemy was not only ready to fight, they were ready to kill.
Whereas Imam Hussein had to do the ultimate sacrifice, and he wasn't a submissive person. He wasn't a lamb going to the slaughter. There was no instance of going there just for the sake of being killed. Imam Hussein, in fact, we know as a fact, he fought up to the last drop of his blood.
And Hussein was not only to sacrifice his life, but he was to sacrifice whatever he had and all those who were dearest to him.
There's no way you should compromise with injustice. And that's the example. It's the example with practically all the imams and certainly all the prophets. They displayed this courage. It's the inspiration that he gave everybody and still does today. It's pretty clear. And so it's a benchmark. It's a he represents the ultimate sacrifice.
He would provide hope to all the oppressed today. And he would illustrate that numbers mean nothing if you're in the right. He would just mean hope. Numerical majority doesn't count when it comes to right and wrong.
Having the benefit of retrospect, we see how right Hussein was. I mean, he set the example in the history. There is no doubt about it. That is magnificent. The example that Hussein set in the history, I think he did something that his grandfather, the Prophet, peace be on him, expected from him to do, to somehow setting the standard against someone like Yazid.
Over 1,300 years have passed since this event, but Imam Hussein's brutal death is still commemorated. The day is known as Ashura, and remembering its message has spread across the world, including Britain. Why?
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee has vowed to investigate corruption allegations in President Donald Trump's Justice Department. Please stay with us for more. In the U.S., the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee has vowed to investigate corruption allegations in former President Donald Trump's Justice Department. Details of the story are given in the website salon.com. The Senate Judiciary Committee announced on Monday, 12th of September, that it will probe former federal prosecutor Jeffrey Berman's claim that former President Donald Trump and Attorney General Bill Barr sought to pressure federal prosecutors to go after Trump's perceived enemies. Judiciary Chairman Dick Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois, said in a letter to Attorney General Merrick Garland that the panel will investigate claims of astonishing and unacceptable deviations by Department of Justice officials to pursue partisan prosecutions and William Barr's efforts to replace Berman with a Trump loyalist. Berman's claims indicate multiple instances of political interference, Dick Durbin wrote, calling on the Department of Justice to produce all documents and communications related to Berman's claims. It violated all the norms and traditions of the Department of Justice, which is supposed to be independent from politics. Berman told MSNBC's Rachel Maddow on Monday. He said, "Trump turned the department into his own personal law firm. He put in people who would do his bidding. And they would, you know, target Trump's political enemies and assist Trump's friends. And it was a disgrace." Berman, a Republican former Trump transition official who served as a U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York until he was fired by Donald Trump in June of 2020, wrote in his upcoming book, Holding the Line, that he resisted the worst of the attempted interference, whether from Maine Justice or from the White House, according to an excerpt published by the New York Times. Berman was fired by Donald Trump after he refused William Barr's request for him to resign after he led the prosecutions of multiple Trump allies, drawing allegations of corruption at the Department of Justice. Berman wrote that William Barr pushed his office to drop its prosecution of former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen, who was ultimately convicted on 8 federal charges, including campaign finance violations that he claimed were on behalf of Donald Trump. Berman told ABC News that Department of Justice officials also pressured his office to remove references to Donald Trump from Michael Cohen's indictment. On the eve of Michael Cohen's guilty plea, Maine Justice tried to get our office to remove any reference to individual one, who was President Donald Trump, he said. They were unsuccessful in that venture, and they were unsuccessful in every attempt to politically interfere with our office. We held the line in every instance. Berman also claims that Justice Department officials pressured his office to prosecute former State Secretary of State John Kerry. Donald Trump publicly called for John Kerry to be prosecuted over claims that he discussed the nuclear deal with Iranian leaders while Donald Trump was in office. When Berman declined to prosecute John Kerry, Department of Justice officials asked another U.S. attorney's office, which likewise declined, according to Berman. That was truly outrageous, Berman told ABC News on Monday. President Trump attacks John Kerry in 2 tweets, saying that Kerry engaged in possible illegal conversations with Iranian officials regarding the Iran nuclear deal. The very next day, the Trump Justice Department refers the John Kerry criminal case to the Southern District of New York. 2 tweets by the president, and the John Kerry criminal case becomes a priority. Berman also claimed that Department of Justice officials told his deputy to charge Democratic lawyer Greg Craig ahead of the 2018 midterm elections to even things out. Craig was ultimately prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, D.C., but was acquitted by a jury in less than 5 hours of charges that he misled the Department of Justice about his lobbying work for Ukraine. The Justice Department told us, "Hey, you have just indicted two allies of President Trump, Chris Collins, who is a Republican congressman from upstate New York, and Michael Cohen, who was the president's lawyer and fixer. And it's time for you guys to even things out and indict a Democrat before the midterm elections," Berman told ABC News. "It was something we had never heard before or seen before." The Bloomberg News Agency also covers the same story from a different perspective. The chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee vowed to investigate allegations in a new book that President Donald Trump's Justice Department demanded that critics of the president be prosecuted. These reported claims indicate astonishing and unacceptable deviations from the department's mission to pursue impartial justice, which requires that its prosecutorial decisions be free from political influence, Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois wrote in a letter on Monday to Attorney General Merrick Garland, asking for information regarding the allegations. Senator Dick Durbin's concerns center around the book Holding the Line by Jeffrey Berman, the former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, whose ouster 2 years ago raised questions about political interference in a set of investigations into Donald Trump, his companies, and people close to him. If accurate, Jeffrey Berman's claims indicate multiple instances of political interference in the department's investigative and prosecutorial decisions, Senator Durbin said. He added, "The Senate Judiciary Committee will certainly investigate these episodes." Jeffrey Berman stepped down in June of 2020 during an acrimonious and public confrontation with the then Attorney General William Barr. At the time, Jeffrey Berman said he stepped down only after being told that a trusted deputy would succeed him, and in light of Attorney General William Barr's decision to respect the normal operation of law. The Justice Department confirmed that it had received Senator Durbin's letter but declined further comment. William Barr on Monday night declined to comment on the book, which is scheduled to be published on Tuesday. The Senate panel investigation would add to the list of legal challenges facing the former president. The Justice Department has subpoenaed dozens of campaign operatives and allies of Donald Trump as part of a broad effort to collect information relating to the plot to overturn the 2020 presidential election, according to people familiar with the matter.
Hidden Files.
That's right, 40 acres and a mule. After 246 years of slavery, that is what African Americans who had been enslaved were promised by the U.S. government. Well, that was back in 1865, and although that was no real compensation for 2.5 centuries of slavery, even that promise was not kept towards black Americans. It became symbolic of all the other promises, laws, programs that were supposed to bring about more economic parity with whites for black Americans, but never took place. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Today, we're going to take you on a journey that started centuries ago on the African continent and yet still has proportional consequences on millions of African Americans today. Estimates vary from $6 trillion to $60 trillion, the value of those 40 acres and a mule today. Well, the wealth never paid to the former slaves nor their descendants. The generational wealth that was never passed down, that opportunity, like so many others, that was never provided to blacks, while endless opportunities, grants, raises, stipends, etc., were given to white Americans. The results show a staggering difference between black and white wealth, even in America today.
In 2019, the median white household was worth $188,200. The median black household held $24,100 in wealth. White households had 7.8 times more wealth than blacks. In 2020, whites made up 60% of the U.S. population, but held 84% of the total household wealth. Black households, who constituted 13.4% of the U.S. population, held 4% of the total household wealth. White households inherit over 5.3 times more than black households. And white households are 2.8 times more likely than black households to inherit any wealth.
Well, we're going to dig into this issue further with our first guest, Cam Howard.
Cam Howard is a reparations expert who has been fighting for decades to get reparations for black Americans. He has addressed the United Nations and has traveled the world presenting the case for reparations for African Americans. He's an administrator for NCOBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America.
Thanks so much for being with us. Do you think that black Americans should get reparations, and if so, why?
So I certainly believe that blacks in this country should get reparations. And it's primarily because of, you know, two reasons. One, there's never been justice and fairness in any large measure for African Americans, people of African descent in this country. As you know, we came here as stolen, kidnapped people from the continent of Africa to slave in the cotton fields and tobacco fields and rice fields in America, and then later in some of the factories during the industrial age. The tremendous amount of crimes were committed against us during the period of enslavement. But then after the period of enslavement, we had a brief period called Reconstruction in this country where there was some semblance of fairness and justice. Then that was followed by another 80 plus years of terroristic apartheid by white supremacist organizations in this country that removed, again, all notions of fairness and justice in the areas of education, in areas of economics, in the area of labor, employment, et cetera. There was criminal punishment, criminal justice. There's been no fairness. There was no fairness. It was an apartheid system backed by the terror of the state. And then after the Jim Crow period, apartheid period in this country, in 1965 and their 60s, as a result of the civil rights movement, we had a small window of fairness and justice with the Civil Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act, and the Voting Rights Act that was passed. And then in the 70s, we had a semblance of fairness with affirmative action. But all those things have been stripped down, taken away the teeth of what should have been given to us in the area of fairness and justice, they've been watered down. So when you look at the police violence in our communities, it's still a continuation of the non-fair and non-just treatment that we receive in this country. So, you know, only a brief, very brief periods in this country of African Americans ever received the type of fair and just treatment that immigrants and people who are, you know, other Americans or people who just come to America, they receive just by being on within these boundaries. But African Americans as a whole, we have not shared any type of governmental fairness and justice for the long haul. Secondly, reparations are due because of the tremendous injury that we still suffer from today as a result of these hundreds of years, centuries of mistreatment in this country. When you look at every area of people of activity in this country, Blacks on the bottom of every good list and on the top of every bad list, whether it's education, whether it's housing, whether it's criminal punishment, whether it's wealth, whether it's, you know, health, maternal mortality, infant mortality, all these things, you see a stark difference between Black lived experience and white lived experiences in this country.
Well, what type of reparations are you proposing?
We look at reparations in the forms of, from the international law standpoint, of gross crimes committed by a state against the civilian population, where that tends to lay out what is known as full reparation. It's just five basic components. First component is cessation and guarantees of non-repetition. First, you must stop the bad acts. You must eliminate the public policy that disproportionately negatively affect people of African descent in this country. That's first and foremost. The criminal justice laws, the housing laws, the economic laws that exist, the disproportionate resource allocation toward education and other aspects of our community. First, you must cease those policies and then put in place structures that ensure that those policies don't show up again. Like when enslavement ended, enslavement resurfaced for another 45 years in the form of convict leasing, in the form of sharecropping, in the form of debt peonage, where, you know, that we still existed in enslavement, but it was not called enslavement. So we need to stop these bad policies that exist today and make sure that we put in structures that they don't resurface. The second component of full reparations is restitution. How do you return the people back to where they would have been had these crimes not committed? So we're talking centuries of crime. So there's going to be multiple generations of repair that's necessary in the areas of education, in the areas of economic development and wealth building and employment and these type of areas and land acquisition and housing. All these areas have to be addressed and redressed with targeted resources. The third component is compensation. When restitution doesn't alleviate a situation, the compensation is an obligatory form of reparations under international norms. And we certainly know that in order for us to have some type of parity and wealth in this country, there's going to have to be some type of direct compensation. We don't know what that be and how much it would be, but certainly we are fighting for that because it is, again, obligatory under international law to redress a situation in its entirety. The fourth component of full reparations is satisfaction. How do you return the dignity back to a people whose dignity was eroded as a result of the crimes you committed against them? Sometimes an apology will do that. Other times, you know, museums, markers, removing a statuary, creating monuments, new monuments, curriculum overhaul, truth and reconciliation commissions, those type of things lend to dignity. Return or satisfaction. And then the fifth component is rehabilitation for the mind, heart, and spirit damage to the people as a result of the crimes. Black people in America have the worst health profile among any people. Our health profile is similar to those in quote-unquote third world countries in certain areas. Highest rates of cancer, highest rate of heart attack, highest rates of infant mortality, maternal mortality, as I stated, highest rates of breast cancers among women, the highest rates of testicular cancer or prostate cancer among men. I mean, the health profile is terrible. And we know now through transgenerational epigenetic inheritance that that health profile is a result of the historical trauma we've experienced as a people in this country.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Cam Howard. We're going to take a look at a few instances that have taken place over the years and why African Americans are demanding reparations. You know, slavery launched modern capitalism. and actually turned the United States into the wealthiest country in the world. Looking at this cotton production, I mean, by the 1830s, 77% of U.S. cotton was used for the British textile industry. And look at that, 2.25 billion pounds of cotton in 1859. And, you know, the cotton actually built New York City as a commercial and financial center. And if you look at the whole worth after the outbreak of the Civil War and the values of slaves, $3 billion, 48% of total wealth in the South in 1860. So very valuable commodity. The emancipation, though, of African Americans did not bring about any type of economic freedom. There were continual policies to make sure that they never got their rights, starting off, of course, with not getting the 40 acres and a mule. However, the slave owners in the South, they actually got compensation after the Civil War, $300 per slave loss or freed. And throughout the time, the safety nets for other Americans were never in place for African Americans, not the loans, not the access to affordable housing in good neighborhoods. There was redlining to prevent them. And even when they could take off a little and be successful in some type of business, as we see like Black Wall Street, then there were efforts to totally eliminate and annihilate any type of success that they had. I mean, this is just a very, very small example of some of the reasons why African Americans are demanding reparations.
Kalonji Jamachanga currently serves as co-chair of the Urban Survival and Preparedness Institute and is co-founder of Black Power Media. He has fought on multiple fronts, tackling issues from local and national police brutality cases to international human rights violations. Under Kalonji's direction, as founder and national coordinator of the FTP movement, programs such as International Feed the People and the National Coalition to Combat Police Terrorism have matured and developed. He has shared his experiences in the best-selling book, How to Build a People's Army, and the documentary, Organizing is the New Cool.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Kalonji Jamachanga. What's your perspective in general regarding reparations?
You know, when I think of reparations, you know, most people think reparations is money. That's not what we're talking about. Our first order of operation is our political prisoners, because like any other civilized nation, whenever there is war or there's any type of, fighting or what have you, any type of disagreements, the first thing before anything can go down is they want their captives back. You know what I mean? So we want our political prisoners back first and foremost. And it is my belief that if we are, the question around reparations should also include the continent of Africa. I think that, the first thing should be, they should be paying reparations to folks on the continent because they stole not only the land, not only the minerals and the wealth, they stole us, they stole humans, you know? So, we totally believe that reparations should be paid, but will it be paid? We don't believe this country is capable of that type of, accountability or respect for us as a whole.
What type of reparations in general do you think would be necessary?
You know, land is definitely, you know, is necessary. You know, we're not just talking about some cash because we know that the U.S. dollar doesn't mean anything. And we know that if they gave us reparations with cash, then they'll just raise the prices up. They'll hike the prices up. You know, so, you know, that's a foolish notion that all we want is money. You know, we know that the American dollar has no real value across the globe. They place their own value on it. You know, so we don't want anything that they can take away. What we'd really like you said, is to be left alone. What we really like is to folks to say, you know what, we want to return these goods. We want to make good with our people. But we know that under a capitalist society, we know that capitalism is a violent system. You cannot have capitalism without the pain and suffering of others. They package it well. They make you feel comfortable and make you feel like, you know, yes, you should be a part of the capitalist system and you should grow and, you know, everything's going to be all right. But it's not the case. They let a few quote unquote African-Americans and a few so-called minorities, or should we say other oppressed people, give them the illusion of power. And, you know, power is about self-determination. So if you don't have self-determination and you don't have a place of your own and you don't have your own tongue and your own culture, then again, you are a displaced person. You are a person that's running around trying to find themselves. And that is how they have us right now. So we're talking about 500 years of this practice of terrorism. So we must understand that, unfortunately, in this country in particular, when you are, you know, their success has to equal your failure. Someone has to be at the bottom and someone has to be at the top. And in the capitalist system, the folks at the bottom will always get stepped on in order to benefit those who are at the top, the oppressors.
In your perspective, what are some of the systemic efforts that have taken place in order to prevent African Americans from achieving equality?
The whole notion of equality is a myth, because we were brought here as chattel slaves, as surplus labor. We were brought here as, you know, as treated like domesticated animals. You know, so they looked at us as property. They never looked at us as equal. You know, even on paper, they said we were 3/5 of human beings. They didn't even consider us a human being. Matter of fact, the quote unquote forefathers of this country, they treated us like objects. You know, even when you talk about folks like George Washington, these are, you know, most of the men who happen to be on the money here, the dollar bills and the cash and the coins, these are former slave masters. You know, these are folks who gave away Africans. And we don't consider ourselves slaves. We were enslaved, because we weren't slaves when we encountered these folks. So we were enslaved Africans. So, these are folks who literally gave us away. George Washington's wife gave Africans away for wedding gifts. They gave us away like we were poodles, or like we were some type of plants, or some type of exotic horse. You know what I'm saying? Like we were camels. We were treated as nothing more than, you know, like I said, domesticated animals. Like we were tricks. We performed for these people. We worked for these people. We built for these people. And in turn, we were enslaved, we were tortured. And to this very day, we are victims of a systematic oppression, which, again, stems from capitalism and global white supremacy. This is what it's all about. You know, capitalism and enslavement are Siamese twins.
We're just about out of time, Mr. Changa, but do you have any final thoughts?
I would like to say that people of the world, oppressed people, quote unquote, third world people, we have to resist imperialism at every turn. We have to, you know, like it says in Islam, we have to change things with our hands. And if we can't change it with our hands, we have to speak out against it. And if we don't speak out against it, then we at least have to hate it in our hearts. We have to remember that we are here for a limited time, and we have the right to exist. We have the right to love. We have the right to be our natural selves. And no man, woman, or child should be able to exploit, dominate, or oppress us.
Very powerful words. Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files. From 1619, when the first Africans were enslaved in what would become the United States, until the present, Africans and their descendants in that country have never been considered as equals with their white counterparts. They have been the victims of systemic terrorism as they have built that country, and now they are demanding their fair share of it. Will they get reparations? Will their demands be met? Not likely, but we will continue to follow their story, their cases, and their demands for justice. And we'll bring you all the latest on that right here at Hidden Files. And make sure you join me and the team right here next week as we dig into another Hidden File. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Arbaeen March, A Story of Love.